the subject, Introduction to the Torah. And he's asked as an introduction that we take Genesis 15, starting at verse 12. Genesis chapter 15, beginning at verse 12. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. He said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And it came to pass that when the sun went down, and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between these pieces. In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites, and the Kenizzites, and the Cadmonites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Rephaims, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. It's my pleasure then to ask Brother Kevin to speak to us on the subject, Introduction to the Torah.
Well, good evening, brothers and sisters. Good to be with you, and greetings from the brothers and sisters at Walsall. So this is a subject that was given to me by another ecclesia. They seem to have been very specific in their title. They've asked for the introduction to the Torah rather than the books of Moses or the law or anything else. That was what was asked for. So you've got them to blame for it. It was, if you want the name, it was West Birmingham Ecclesia. So you can get them afterwards. But nevertheless, this seemed to go down okay with them. They didn't run me out of time, so I thought I'd try it on with you as well. So what I want to do really is look at this subject in four sections, differing sort of lengths of the sections. I want to think about the content of the Torah, the compilation, putting together of the Torah, the themes that we find in the Torah, and then finally just sort of looking back from after the event, from forward in history, back to the times of the Torah, how it has been taken up and used later in Scripture, and particularly in the New Testament. So there might be one or two interesting facts along the way, or random facts, depending on your sort of penchant for facts here. What we're taking to be the Torah, and the word Torah means instruction or teaching in Hebrew. It's the first five books of the Tanakh. And the Tanakh is this, our first interesting fact. This is something I never knew, so I started looking at this. Tanakh is another Hebrew word, but it's a totally made up word. It's one of these words, a bit like laser, where you just got some initials put together and it seems to form a new word. So the word Tanakh was created to help shorten the three parts of the Jewish scriptures. The teaching, the Torah, the prophets, the Nevim, and the writings, the Ketuvim. So Torah, and Keh put together, and you make this random word, Tanakh. So they refer to the scriptures as the Tanakh, and the Torah, the teaching, is the first five books. And I guess, just to remind ourselves, that what we're thinking about tonight is the only scriptures for certain people. So for the Sadducees and the Samaritans, this was all that they had as their words from God, their authority from God. Obviously, the Sadducees are long gone. I believe there are still Samaritans practicing the Samaritan religion existing in the world today, but they number in the hundreds. Okay, so there are Samaritans. The Samaritan Torah is exactly like the Hebrew Torah, the Jewish Torah, except it has a few little changes here and there. A little, perhaps, like the religion of Islam, changes some of the facts that we have in the Bible. So this is perhaps the key one that I've just noted on the screen. And sorry if the writing's a bit small for you, but you have sat at the back, so it's sort of half your fault as well. right at the time of the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, straight after the Ten Commandments in the Samaritan version of the Torah, there's this little extra verse that they throw in that tells them that there is a command to build an altar at Mount Gerizim, the place Yahweh has chosen to dwell. And you can see that that's conflicting quite strongly, and that's why the Jews and the Samaritans conflicted during the time of Jesus, because the Samaritans followed this extra verse, whereas the Jews took it as spurious. Of course, for the Jews, in Deuteronomy, the place God will choose has yet to be revealed. But for the Samaritans, they took it to be Mount Gerizim. We also know these books together as the Pentateuch. So another random or interesting fact is that that means five-volumed. Or five component parts to the thing. So we tend to know it as the book or the books of Moses. That's the traditional title that the King James Bible and others apply to it in the contents pages sometimes. But that idea of the Pentateuch, even before our books of Moses, does it not suggest some sort of unity to the five books? You know, it's not five books, it's five volumes of a particular thing that it came to be known as in the Greek. So we know our five books. I guess I'm doing this sort of like seminar-like, so hopefully it's not too dumbed down for everybody, and there may be some little snippets along the way that you pick up as facts that might be new. So there are our first five books. There's what we call them in English. You know the names. You can see how they got their names. So Genesis, Greek there for origin, just sort of come into English. Exodus, the Greek going out of Egypt. So that's how it's got its name. And going on through. In Hebrew, you probably know that they have different names that they call the five books by. They're a little less imaginative than we are, perhaps. They just use the opening phrase of each book to give it its name. So Genesis is Bereshith, which in Hebrew just means in the beginning, because that happens to be the first phrase in the book, and so on down. Exodus, these are the names, because Exodus starts with the names of a family. I wonder if you could spot the odd one out in English in our five names, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Is there something there that stands out as different from the other four, I wonder? I'll leave you to puzzle that for a second. So the answer is Numbers. All of the others, we bring into English a sort of transliteration of the Greek word, whereas with Numbers, we've translated it. So it would have been, if we were following the pattern on three with all the sort of transliteration into English from Greek, we'd be calling the book of Numbers something like Arithmetics or Arithmoi as our book name, but we don't, we call it Numbers. Right, there is a broad outline of our five volumes, and to my mind it splits very clearly into two major sections: the book of Genesis, section 1, and the other four books as section too. And that happens very much in the fact that there is a break in time between the two sections. But it also works, I think, in a way that Genesis serves as an introduction and a bringing of the people of Israel and how they came to be in the land of Egypt. And that's where we move towards as we work our way through Genesis. And then in Exodus, we start with them in Egypt sometime later. And we work through the four books into the moving on the journey out of Egypt towards the promised land. We have, and this is just my analysis, it's just how I saw it as I flicked my way through the pages of the five books and thought, well, what's in the books? How can I sort of get them in my head and think of them as some sort of structure? I broke it down into main sections, having just coincidentally seven main sections. So pre-Abraham, the patriarchs, Joseph and his brothers in Egypt. That's our first section. And then the second section, Israel from Egypt going to Sinai, the time spent at Sinai, failure and lost years in the middle in Numbers, and then approaching Canaan's borders. And it seemed to me that it was interesting that the numbers of chapters that are dedicated to those different sort of periods or different sections of our subject tonight, comparing it with the number of years which those sections seem to cover. So you very much get, when you look at that, a feeling that there is concentration and focus on particular incidents and time periods. So you'll recognise right from the beginning that that happens with a real slowdown and focus on the flood in the very first pre-Abraham section. We have generation after generation passed over very briefly in a few chapters, and then we spend three or four chapters very much concentrated on a year or so in the life of Noah. And the same thing happens, it rushes on then to come all the way from Noah to Abraham, and we spend chapters, so a long chapter, say in chapter 24, just focused on the marriage of, or the finding of a wife for Isaac. And then even more so, we get a real slowing down in the narrative when we get to the life of Joseph. And we spend 13 chapters covering a very sort of, or just one lifetime, or part of a lifetime. And the opposite of that, again, later on in Numbers, we spend only maybe 10 and a half chapters thinking about the time from failure to go into the land all the way through to the next generation and then being on the borders and then going into that, being ready to go into the land. And even there, most of that time, or a lot of that time, is spent with the prophecies of Balaam. Okay, so very much a contrast in the way that the narrative slows down and speeds up, passes over things and decides, no, this thing, this event, this life, or this thing in that person's life is incredibly important for us to know about. I tried to sort of visualise it a bit. I don't know if this really works at all, but I tried to visualise it another way. Now, I don't think you can see it, but there's an arrow sort of going that way to say time is going that way as well. I'm not even sure now I remember exactly what I was trying to do with this diagram, but I think it's something like this, that the time that is covered by each book, I've tried to show by how fat the thing is. So Genesis is much fatter, and it's totally out of scale, because if it was real as to how much time it's supposed to be covering, Genesis would be much fatter than that. It also shows again that Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, is very much not really in time at all. It's a code of law, and the narrative that comes in Leviticus is very a small part of the book and is only over a very small period of time whilst they are at Sinai. I think the other thing I was trying to show here was that the heaviness, perhaps, if I can say it like that, the heaviness of a book, so the density of the information, and to me, Leviticus was the one that is perhaps the densest and the heaviest of a read to digest for us. Whereas Deuteronomy versus something like Exodus and Numbers, Deuteronomy is a lot more excitational, particularly in the first few chapters of Deuteronomy, where, as we'll see later in the detail of what's in Deuteronomy, Moses takes the law and he gives us an inspired excitation, an unpacking of it, and trying to get us to see the implications of what it means for our walk before God. Now, so sometimes these books might be, we might call them, refer to them as the Law of Moses. So another question for you to think about is, how much of these five books do we think is law? I'm talking now in percentage terms and just numbers of chapters or numbers of words. What percentage do you think of those five books is law versus not law? So maybe just story or narrative. What do you think? 50% law? 60? 70? Higher? Lower?
Lower.
Where would you go then? 10% law? All of Leviticus is in there. That's all law.
But how much law is in Genesis?
Lots of law. Yeah, so that's right. Not much law in Genesis. Well, I was surprised because I would find something like, 50%. If you, like you said, nothing much in Genesis. Okay, we got a story, the narrative at the start of Exodus of them coming out. But after that, there's a lot of law. And including the building of the tabernacle in law. Leviticus, that's all law. Deuteronomy, isn't that all law? Numbers, maybe half and half again. Well, I counted up the chapters and that's what I found. So, you're right, it was lower. It comes out about 37%. If you exclude Genesis, if you just take the last four books, it's basically half and half, on the way I counted it anyway. So I did it by chapter counts. And at the most, I sort of split it into half chapters. So you're right, Genesis, not much law at all. Although, say not much law in Genesis, we do get several hints at laws, don't we? We do get passing references to things that are like or expanded in the other four books with clean and unclean, the Sabbath day, sacrifices and altars. So there's clearly some established law there, even if we're not given it like we're given it in the other four books. And like you might expect, Leviticus comes out heavy on the law side. I think I was surprised at these two. Only sort of half and half Numbers and half Deuteronomy are giving of law, and the other half is either a narrative of what is happening at the time, or is it a recounting by Moses of what happened at the time? And the other thing, as I thought about the law of Moses, is I think from my Sunday school days, I felt of the law of Moses as a big fat wad of law. There was lots of it. It was very detailed. It was very confusing. And it just seemed to go on a long time. But when you look back at it, or when you think of it now, in the terms of it's only 37% here, and it's only whatever section of our Bible it is, when we think of it in terms of modern law, it's really slim line. Now, the numbers of laws, the amounts of pages that are dedicated to the writing of laws in modern states, is huge, huge compared to the laws of Moses. It is very light touch. It also is a particular type of law, or slant on the law, a subtopic of the law, because it focuses on the relationship with God, obviously much more than modern law does. Offerings, clean and unclean, festivals, the construction of the tabernacle, they're all to do with worship. And once you start trying to think about everyday life for the Jewish person living under the law, and think, well, how would they live by these laws, it becomes apparent very quickly that they needed case law. That the law as we have it doesn't deal with every situation that could arise, and that's why the judges were appointed and why the judges brought or administered case law. And that came true, didn't it, over time, that the Jews are renowned for the way that they have developed whole systems of extra laws that they've added on top of the things revealed to us in the scripture. And it's not surprising, because the laws do not cater for absolutely every circumstance that might arise in the life of an Israeli. Right, so I've now, the next few slides, I've broken down how I saw the five books. I said I thought there was seven major sections. So here we have the first three of those in Genesis, and I've broken them down further, and you won't be able to read those, and I don't think it's really necessary that you do read those, or all of them. But just perhaps you might get the idea that the relative height of the different sections is supposed to be indicative of the numbers of chapters that are given over to each of these sections. So I guess what you can see there is that before Abraham is actually a very small part of Genesis. It's obviously the first 11 chapters out of 50 of Genesis. And the things that really are focused on there, as we've already said, is the flood. That first 11 chapters has its own sort of flavour to it, its own characteristic. It's quite sketchy, apart from that one year in the life of Noah and the events of Eden. We have very little in terms of how the individuals were thinking, what they were saying. There's lots of just description of events as pure narrative. And it feels like, to me at least, it's very much written with an introduction to the introduction. I said what we're trying to drive towards is Israel in Egypt, how they got there, and then how they came out again. This is the introduction to Abraham, how Abraham came to be called out of Ur. It's setting the background for the life of Abraham. And then the main section of Genesis is the life of the patriarchs. And interestingly, when we think about the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, when you try to do some sort of structure analysis on Genesis, that section of Genesis, Isaac seems to fade into the background a little bit. He's not perhaps mentioned, it's not focused on as much as we might have at first thought. There's lots on Abraham, there's a transition through Isaac, but then there's a lot again on Esau and particularly Jacob. And one of the themes that seems to me to come out of Genesis is the idea of journeying. And that follows on, obviously, into the Exodus itself. But in Genesis, you've got things going on like the movement of populations in general up in the early first section, and the way that they come to build the Tower of Babel and how they're scattered. You've got the journey of Abraham out of Ur, as a main sort of theme of what's going on, and his wanderings as a pilgrim sojourner in the land through and into Egypt and back again. The whole account of Jacob's life that we have in scripture is all structured around his journey. His journey out from Bethel to Aram, his time with Laban, his being deceived as he had been a deceiver, and his coming back and his meeting his brother after so many years. And finally, he comes back to Bethel again. And there's a really clear, I think, structural sort of pinning there of Jacob's life with Bethel and going out and coming back on this journey, and the vow that he makes to God at the start of that. And of course, even in the life of Joseph, we've got transition and journeyings from the land down into Egypt. So Exodus, the first 15 chapters, God fighting for his son, Israel. And of course, Israel means God fights, fighting with God, God fights. And there is very much a battle going on in the first 15 chapters of Exodus, with God triumphing over Pharaoh. And it ends, doesn't it, with the rout, the destruction of Pharaoh's army, the horse and the rider, thrown into the sea. The middle section of Exodus is the travelling to Sinai and the promise that God had made being confirmed to them, the covenant being confirmed with them at Sinai, the Ten Commandments right at the heart of this section. And then the section ends with the bit where the people are sprinkled with the blood as the Book of the Covenant is confirmed. And the last of the three major sections of Exodus is the construction of the tabernacle. Now, this is another, I found, fascinating fact, but I don't know I've got anything that sort of says why it's the way it is. It just is the way it is. And it is the way that, do you know these things in Hebrew? I forget what they're called. They're called something like chiasms or something. The way that the structure goes, with the thing that's most important put in the middle, and either side of the thing in the middle, you get a symmetry where the things either side, immediately either side, are reflective of each other, they're similar. And then further out, there are pairs that correspond to each other. And so right at the start and right at the end, you may have something corresponding as well. And it's called a chiasm sort of structure, I think. Well, we've got a giant one of them here at the end of Exodus. So imagine this like a double sandwich or something. I have to use my five fingers, I think, for this. Right at the start of this section, you've got about the instructions that God gives for the tabernacle, right? Right at the end, you've got the construction of the tabernacle. It tells us it twice. It was to be constructed, and it was constructed. And then sat in between that, well, right in the middle, is the incident with the golden calf and God's revelation of himself to Moses as a result of that incident. And sat right between those two things are two very small little sections. So it must be chapter 31 and the beginning of chapter 35. And they both tell us about the law of the Sabbath. Okay, so something quite structured going on there over a number of chapters. The tabernacle, then the Sabbath law, and as you come in, right in the middle, God revealing himself to Moses. And that's the sort of structure that repeats often in Hebrew. And if I'm going to throw out some conjecture as to why it's structured like that, perhaps it's something like this. We're thinking about the holiness of God, God being amongst his people. And that's with the tabernacle. That's the major theme of the section. And the Sabbath law was indicative of the holiness of God and the way that God rested on the seventh day and enjoyed his creation, dwelt in his creation and enjoyed it. But right in the middle is the thing to be emphasized about God dwelling amongst his people. And that is that his character is shown. So not just the idea of worshipping God or having God somewhere for a place for God to live, but that the key thing, the vital thing that we are to know about God and come close to in our worship of God is the revelation of his character. And that's the Holy of Holies, if you like. seeing right at the centre the things that God said of himself to Moses. Okay, there's Leviticus. It's all one colour, because it's all one section as far as I could see. I perhaps lost a bit of inspiration when I got to Leviticus. But what is it? It is a code for purity and holiness. That seems to me what comes out time and time again in Leviticus. I am holy. God says so. You be holy. The purity laws are there for food, for childbirth, for leprosy, for houses, for bodily discharges. And the only bit of narrative that we have is this little bit here. And even that is to do with purity and holiness, because it's the failure of Nadab and Abihu to remain pure and holy in their service as priests. And all of that is given or takes place whilst Israel are at Sinai. So Numbers almost could read straight on from Exodus, if you like. You could take Leviticus as a giant parenthesis and aside, because it follows on straight, really, from Numbers, from Exodus. So we got the rest of the time at Sinai, the failure of the first generation, and then the next generation coming towards the promised land. And what we have in this first section is then the preparation for the people to leave Sinai and to go out towards the promised land. And very clearly in this first section, they become not just a people, a crowd, sort of following Moses out of Egypt. They are now to become an ordered society, and they are to become a marching army. Okay, that seems to be a clear thing that's done with all the numbering and the way that they are to walk in order and the way they are to camp. They're being described almost as an army as they prepare to move into the promised land. Got the sad catalogue of grumbling and rebellion in the middle chapters of Numbers. And somehow, and it seems almost deliberate the way this happens in the record, somehow we transition from the first generation into the second generation. And if you can spot the place where that transition happens really clearly, then you're doing better than I can, because it is there. You know, Miriam and Aaron, you can't read the story, but Miriam and Aaron die around chapter 20, chapter 21. And back in chapter 14, 15, 16, we were very much at the time when they'd just been leaving Sinai. And then there's this little bit about instruction for the Levites and the priests, and the bit about the red heifer, so we get back into law again. And it's moved on, a whole generation, just like that. And it didn't really make a big deal of it. It just went, and a generation was forgotten. And the journeys and the day-to-day life is just a darkness to us, other than a resume that happens in chapter 33 of Numbers of the different places where they camped along the way. And Deuteronomy becomes easier again, I think, to analyse. It's Moses giving, first of all, a general exhortation to love the Lord your God, after he's given us the first speech where he just reminds them of the journey that they've come on. And that general exhortation then moves into specific laws and regulations. And that's from chapter 5 to chapter 26 is seems to be all one speech that Moses gives. And in the last few chapters, it fragments up a bit into a variety of speeches, with the cursings and the blessings, the death of Moses right at the end. Now, before I flip to the next slide, another question for you. Specific laws and regulations. Deuteronomy meant, in Greek, something like second law, second giving of the law. How much of Deuteronomy do you think is a repeat of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers? If everything we find in Deuteronomy already been seen in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers? Is it a whole set of new things that we never saw before, or is it 50-50? What do you think? I was called Deuteronomy, and I know that lots of things get repeated. Before I looked at this, my thinking was, oh, it will all be there, pretty much. Maybe one or two little extra bits. But it's not like that at all, actually. There's loads in Deuteronomy that we haven't seen before. And that might not surprise you. It did surprise me when I came to find out. The things we have seen before, clean and unclean foods, Feast of the Passover, weeks, and tabernacles, the cities of refuge. They're all there in either Numbers or Exodus. But look at the list of things that we haven't seen. The one place of worship that God will choose, how to deal with false prophets, cancelling debts every 7 years, how the king was to come and to live, that there would be a prophet like Moses, laws about going out to war, how to deal with unsolved murders, how to deal with rebellious children, the law of divorce, what to do, how to treat your brother's widow, the ceremony of first fruits and tithes, chapter 26. Those are all things that are not found previously in the law. And there does seem to me to be a sort of focus of those things. They bracket together, perhaps, into laws and instruction that was very relevant in the main for the people as they prepared for battle, to fight the inhabitants of the land, and then as they were to inhabit the land. So they're laws that are fit for the time that they were dealing with. Okay, so that's the contents. Just thinking a little bit about the compilation of our five books and how they came to be as they are for us as we read them today. There are, scattered through the five books, explanatory notes to the reader. So there's some examples on the screen. I have others too. So there's some that aren't on the screen. Sometimes it says, it is said to this day, in the mountain of the Lord's provision it is made. Back in Genesis 10, we're told that Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. So sort of explanatory notes to the reader who's reading this after the events that are being recorded. That is why to this day the Israelites do not eat the sinew that is attached to the socket of the hip, is inserted when we read about the way that Jacob's hip was touched. No prophet ever again arose in Israel like Moses. Again, that's a reflection back, isn't it? That Moses lived some time ago, and through all the period since then, there has not been a prophet like Moses. There's some more on the screen. A reference in Exodus chapter 16. So Exodus chapter 16 is before really the 40 years have started in chronological sort of events of the books. But there's a reference there to the fact that the Israelites ate manna for 40 years until their final entry into Canaan. Um, So there's a few more for you to look at on the screen. There's some geography indicators also that we've come across where, again, it's sort of an explanation coming from later times, or the way that the text reads, it reads supposing that the people who were reading it must have come from a later time. So, for example, Dan, the place Dan, is used as a name in Genesis 14 when talking about Abraham and the way that his family, his household, went off to recover Lot after the battle in Genesis 14. But it's only in Judges later on that we come to find that the name of the town, Dan, gets its name. So I think that's called an anachronism, the way that Dan is referred to in Genesis 14 there. There's comments about Moses that, again, appear as though they have been put in after the lifetime of Moses himself. So the comments that Moses was a very great man, the comments that Moses was a humble man, and of course, right at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, we're told about the death of Moses and the events after the death of Moses. So I think we can say that the five books don't reach their final form in the lifetime of Moses. But we can also say that the final version, if we can really say there's a final version, isn't too late in time. And I'm going to put a stab at maybe the time of Samuel is the time when it comes into its final compiled form as we might know it. And this, I think, is a really key piece of evidence, and it concerns two place names in Genesis chapter 10, Akkad and Calah. Okay, so Akkad was a great city in the Mesopotamian region, but Akkad had gone as a major city, had been destroyed and faded into history by about 900 BC. Okay, so that suggests that you wouldn't be writing about Akkad too much later than 900 BC. Whereas Calah, although it's mentioned in Genesis 10, was a great city, but it was a great city from the time period of about 1200 BC to 612 BC. So that's after the time of Moses, but it's not too late into sort of more modern times. So that was one city gone by about 900 and one that spanned across 1200 to 600 BC. So you can make an argument that perhaps during the reign of Saul or in the time of Samuel, that the final version of our writings that we're thinking about are put together. Now that may sound a little bit sort of scary to say, oh, it's all coming later. Not really at all. Let's sort of row back and go the other way now and say, well, actually, there's lots of references to Moses himself actually writing stuff. So we're really talking about the final compilation. The great body of the stuff that we find in our five books here, we find lots of references to the writings of Moses. There you go, there's a whole series there. Moses wrote all these words of the Lord. He wrote them on the tablets of the word. Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys, Numbers 33. Moses wrote this law and delivered it, Deuteronomy 31. Moses wrote this song that day. When Moses had finished writing the words of this law in a book to the very end, Deuteronomy chapter 31. So, just as I said, the laws of Deuteronomy were very apposite for the actual time that was coming, right then, going into the land. So the book itself says Moses was writing these things down at the time. There's reference to Moses' authorship of the law in the New Testament. There's a whole series on the side there. The one that I highlighted for you is the law of divorce that Jesus gets into discussion about. What did Moses command you, Jesus says? It was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law. Moses permitted you to divorce. So we are calling this the books of Moses, just by sort of common parlance. It has got precedent in how the Jews and how Jesus thought about it in their day. This was Moses doing these things. And there's a few more on the screen there, but particularly the one I've highlighted again shows you that when speaking about what Moses has written, it's more than just the law. Okay, so have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the bush, Jesus says. The passage is about the bush, is Exodus chapter 3, and it's before the law's given. So clearly, the book of Moses is more than just the law of Moses. Okay, I think this will be the final section. We're just thinking now about themes. Themes that are there through the five books that are developed. I've already said one, that's the idea of journeys and travelling. I wonder what you think of when you think of themes that come through the first five books. This is what I came up with. And I've got four of them. Of course there's more. You'll probably think of them in slightly different ways. But I had the choice that is provided to us by God. The idea that there is choice to obey or disobey. And the contrasting characters we meet along the way and the decisions that they make in that process of making a choice. Right from the beginning, there is the tree presented to Adam and to Eve, and a choice is presented to them in the voice of God and the voice of the serpent. There is Cain and the choice that he needs to make as to whether he's going to allow sin to master him or not. There are the two different genealogies of Cain and Seth, daughters of men, sons of God. You know, which way down the family tree do we see ourselves going? Lot chooses Sodom, Abraham chooses to sojourn. They both make conscious choices. Abraham chooses to fellowship with the king of Salem, and he chooses to reject anything at all that the king of Sodom might give him. Esau and Jacob, God's sovereign choice and the choices that they make. Joseph chose above his brothers. Who is on the Lord's side? Moses shouts to the people, and the Levites choose to be on the Lord's side. The 10 spies versus the 2 spies. Who do you listen to? Which is the right voice? Korah versus Aaron and Moses. Who does God choose? Which one is God's choice? And then, of course, the famous passages at the end of Deuteronomy. To obey or to disobey. To choose life or to choose death. To receive blessings or to receive the cursings. Choice and the contrasting outcomes of choice are there all the way through the first five books. Covenants, promises, and of course God's faithfulness in keeping his covenants and his promises are there. So we have a series of covenants that are presented. The covenants and promises with Eve, the promises, the covenants with Noah, whole series of promises we know to Abraham. The way that God works through the life of Jacob and has been faithful to him in his life, going with him wherever he went. The way that Joseph says, God sent me before you to preserve life. Okay, God's faithfully working the national covenant that is made in Exodus chapter 24. And of course, it all comes from the character of God himself, the Lord, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. There's a theme of Israel being God's possession and the holiness and the purity that must come as a result. And that came right back from Genesis as well. So being shut out of Eden is the idea there, isn't there? They've lost the holiness. The flood of a corrupted earth that cleans the world, if you like. Sodom and Gomorrah being destroyed for grave sin. Abraham being called out to be special, to be holy. Called out to leave his country, his people, his family. The rite of circumcision, the covenant of circumcision that's given as a way of demonstrating a possession to God and a holiness to God. Israel is my firstborn son, God says at the start of Exodus. Let my son go that he may serve me. The idea of possession. And that feeds its way all the way through into all of the different purity laws that are there in Leviticus. And even further into the laws of things like no intermarriage with the nations around. Completely destroy the Canaanites, but welcome the sojourner. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine. And then a last theme that perhaps is not as dominant as the others, but there is an explaining perhaps going on often of the present day, as it was when the things were written, to explain the way things are in the political landscape. What do I mean by that? I mean things like the curse on Canaan that's there in Genesis 9. The general origin of the nations that is given to us in Genesis 10. We saw it in our reading about the Amorites and their iniquity being not yet full when God speaks to Abraham and the way that the land was cleansed with Israel coming into it of people like the Amorites. Genesis 19 describes the disgrace of Ammon and Moab in the way that they are conceived. We've got Ishmael and Midian and their lesser portion, where they came from, being given to us in Genesis chapter 25. We have the rejection of Edom in Genesis 27 and 36. We have the theme of Amalek and their destiny to be destroyed at God's command because of the things that Amalek had done to Israel on the way out of Egypt. And these are things that then flow through, as we know, into the history that we have through the rest of our Old Testament writings. Vengeance is to be taken upon the Midianites, Numbers 31. Whereas Egypt and Edom are not to be hated. So the way that Israel were placed amongst the other nations and their relationship to the other nations is something that starts its life and is the history, the background to it is given to us through these first five books. Final slide then. I was asked to speak for an evening on the Torah. That seems like an extreme challenge. even more extreme, if we're just to summarise it up in one slide, what's it all about? Well, the New Testament seems to me to be pretty clear and unambiguous about where to focus in our first five books. All the commandments are summed up in this word: you shall love your neighbour as yourself. Love is the fulfilling of the law. And the most important commandment is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this: you shall love your neighbour as yourself. There is no greater commandment than these. But it takes the New Testament and the life of Jesus, our Lord, to really make us understand the heart of the law, to really see, as we saw in that section in Exodus, of the heart of God's living with the people was how God was in his own character. It takes the life and the death of our Lord and his willingness to give himself in his love for God and his love for his neighbour for us to really start to understand the power and the enormity of the things that God revealed to his people, the nation of Israel, in the Torah. And we thank God that we have built on that solid foundation a more sure hope and a better covenant in our Lord Jesus Christ.